Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Plato. Episode 1, reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Now, before I get too much into it, I should mention that having read a few encyclopedias of philosophy, they're a very good grounding in the field of philosophy. But as for wider influences, when you reach philosophers from in the modern era, they have political influences, mathematical influences. This is a pure philosophy. Plato is a pure philosopher. There may be mathematics in it, but Pythagoras or Kant, Leibniz, Descartes, Francis Bacon, all our philosophers, which I've gone through recently, and reading through, I haven't read this ahead of time. I know some things, some other facts or general knowledge about it, but not the specific knowledge, but very much this is a philosophy-only look at these philosophers. It doesn't look at the wider variety. So Francis Bacon, he didn't talk anything about or very much about his founding of the Royal Society, the novel, the Financial of America, all his influences in that, and said the Colony of Newfoundland. Didn't mention it. Leibniz, another case in point, they didn't really delve into the fact of his work on calculus or binary numbers as the father of digital technology. But one of the things you do find out is that the modern popular science that we're taught is just totally inadequate. So I think our first modern novel people often attribute to Jane Austen, but there's obviously more novels and narratives inside the and even the idea of a novel being an insight into someone's thoughts or inner thoughts, being able to know one intimately. If you even look at the writing of Saint Augustus, his extensive books and writing, these are throwing up a lot of issues for me, in terms of that you read something and you say, oh, he wasn't allowed to publish anything. This is just going down the track of not Francis Bacon, but Roger Bacon, the inventor of the magnifying glass. That, for us, brings up a whole lot of issues about the origin and father of photonics. It's that sort of a very incredible story to look at it. However, I've got much higher expectations for getting a well-rounded look at Plato, because I think everything has been stripped from him except his philosophy, and so it's very likely that this will cover very satisfactory, whereas the other ones, they're cogent, constructed, well-constructed essays, but they're philosophical only essays. It's it gives a really a reference an intradisciplinary look at it. So if you're studying one philosopher and you want to read about another philosopher and read their influence of philosophies, you can see it. But outside here, it is truly an encyclopedia of philosophy, not about philosophy, but it is of philosophy. Okay, let's get into it. Plato, 249, correction, 249, you can see the dyslexia coming in, 429 to 347 BCE. Now remember that they're going backwards, so that makes him a very old man when he calcs it. That's 29 plus 53 makes him, for the ancient world, makes him, was it, what did I say, 29 plus 53 makes him, is that 81? I can't remember. Again, that's, unfortunately, with this brain thing, I just have to rely on my head coming in, giving me answers, is, by any reckoning, one of the most dazzling writers of the Western literary tradition, and one of the most penetrating, wide-ranging, and influential authors in the history of philosophy. An Athenian citizen of high status, he displays in his works his absorption in the political events and intellectual movement of his time, but the questions he raises are so profound, and the strategies he uses for tackling them so richly suggestive and provocative, that educated readers for nearly every period have some way been influenced by him. In practically every age, there has been philosophers who count themselves a Platonist, or Neoplatonist, I suppose you'd say, in some respects. He was not the first thinker or writer to whom the word philosopher should be applied. This is Pythagoras, and who's the person? Thales. But he is so self-conscious about how philosophy should be conceived that it's and what its scope and ambitions properly are, and he so transformed its intellectual currents in which he grappled that the subject of philosophy, as it is often conceived, a rigorous systematic examination of ethical, political, metaphysical, and epistemological issues armed, epistemology means the, I wonder what that means, there's teleological and epistemology, I have to go back and relearn that, armed with a distinctive method, can be called his invention. And now that's a really interesting thing. People practice philosophy, but he is a sort of meta-philosopher. A few other authors in Western history of philosophy approximate him in depth range, perhaps only Aristotle, who has studied with him. Aquinas, Kant should be generally agreed to be in the same rank. St. Thomas Aquinas is, I actually like him. Because he provides a really, not only does he practice philosophy, he provides an exhaustive summa theologica. What a fantastic read. It's like delving yourself into the medieval world. You know how people listen to music from a period, you know, to set the scene. You couldn't. It's just a fantastic, fantastic read. It's such a vivid, personal read, similar theological. I love it. We had a copy of it at home. I just really loved reading that. Section 1, Plato's Central Doctrines. Many people associate Plato with a few central doctrines that are advocated in his writings. This is interesting. The world appears to our senses is in some way defective and filled with error, but there is a more real perfect realm populated with entities called forms or ideas that are eternal, changeless, in some ways paradigmic for the structure and character of the world presented to our senses. This is Plato's theories of forms, that, you know, we see a false, but there is the perfect table, the perfect chair. And although the actual practicality of it is not there, like there is not some universal chair floating in space or on the back of Io or something like that, there's not the perfect chair, the form of the chair, but conceptually it's there. That conceptual form, you need that conceptual form to think, so I definitely count me in on that one. So I don't, obviously it's factually incorrect, but as a methodology I think it's fantastic. Among the most important these abstract objects, as they are now called, that's what I call an abstract object, because it's not located in space or time. Oh, there you go. The goodness, beauty, equality, bigness, lightness, unity, being, sameness, difference, change, and changelessness. These terms, goodness and beauty, and so, are often capitalized by those who write about Plato in order to draw the attention of their exalted status. Yeah, so... Hello, I'm back again from a break. It will sound as though I'm just stopping, because in the podcast world, you know, periods of time which are slight as out in my world seem no time whatsoever, but I've just gone off and taken one of my children to school. We're looking at the theory of forms. And it's sort of like a central idea, but speaking about people, they don't, speaking with people, they've got no interest in it, no interest in the the idea of, you know, what is a concept? You know, what's the concept of goodness and badness and evil and ethicness and, you know, how you can discuss the form of something, and then Aristotle's conversion of that into sort of a practical, usable thing, which basically stuffed the human race. Not that the human race is going to do any better for thousands of years. It's interesting how there was an advance and it's stopped. But the theory of forms, what the ideal form is, and I think people who are, I don't know, they're not that good at philosophy, or they're not very tolerant of it. It's an area of time. So why are you doing that? Isn't it much better to look at Wimbledon or something like that? Isn't it much better to follow the footy than look at philosophy? They might be right, but then they don't have a lot of time for Plato's forms, i.e. there's no such thing as an ideal chair floating around in the universe. Now, bear in mind that Plato was talking to very concrete people, so it's sort of like making it concrete enough for people to jump onto it, in my view. It's sort of like building it into, making it concrete enough for people to engage with it, and then it disappears into the abstract world. It sort of is like a transport mechanism. I see it like that. I see it as a transport portal from your abstract concrete world into the abstract world. And so I think people's concept of, are forms concrete? No, I would say form is a form. Form is a form. The idea of forms is itself a form. That's my view. The most fundamental distinction in Plato's philosophy is between the many observable objects that appear beautiful, good, just, unified, equal, big, and the ones that of what is little beauty, goodness, justice, and unity, really is from those many beautiful, good, just, receive their names and their corresponding characteristics. Nearly every major work of Plato is in some way devoted or interdependent on this distinction. Okay, so something is good, but there is a goodness, which is, you know, again, people can't understand the difference between it even nowadays. Many of them explore the ethical and practical consequences of conceiving reality in a bifurcated way, that is, the concept of goodness and that being good. We are urged to transform our values by taking to heart the greater reality of forms and the effectiveness of the corporeal world. We must recognize that the soul is a different sort of object from the body, so much so that it does not depend on the existence of the body for its functioning, and can in fact grasp there. The nature of forms far more easily when it is not encumbered by its attachment to anything corporeal. In a few of Plato's works, we are told the soul always retains the ability to recollect what is once grasp of the forms when it is disembodied prior to the processor's birth, especially the meno, i.e. that before birth, there is a soul, so that's how concepts come to be. Obviously, we don't believe into that. But it is a mechanism for saying that the concepts exist in a culture. So I would say that there's what we would say is cultural DNA, cultural epigenetics would be an equivalent to that. Well, that's my positive interpretation of it. So epigenetics is the fact that you can have the characteristics of the conditions which affect your mother, because that puts methylation of your genes. And so if your mother starves when she's in her life, then has a baby, that baby will have modified genes. So our form that we receive, according to Plato, is in this ether that your body exists, but I really would put that as the cultural ether. And that lives we lead are to some extent a punishment or reward for choices we made in previous existence, which, you know, what I would say is not we, but our culture has. See especially the final pages of the Republic, and you really have to understand it. If you read the Republic straight off, which I have, So I think it's Republicus, the allegory of the boat. I can't quite remember. A lot of this doesn't make sense. So this is why there is an advantage of studying this in the nude, so to speak. But in many of Plato's writings, it is asserted or assumed that true philosophers who recognize how important it is to distinguish one, the thing of goodness, of virtue and courage, is from the many things that are called virtuous and courageous, are in a position to become ethically superior to an unenlightened human beings because of the greater degree of insight they can acquire. To understand things which are good and why they are good, and if not interested in such questions, how can we become good? We must investigate the form of good. This is basically why educate people in ethics. Plato's puzzles. This is item 2, we're 15 minutes in. Although these propositions are often identified by Plato's readers as forming a large part of the core of his philosophy, many of his greatest admirers and most careful students point out that few, if any, of his writings can accurately be described as mere advocacy of a cut-and-dried group of propositions. Well, that, I couldn't agree more with that in terms of, and this is why we're reading into it, mate. This is why your listeners are listening to you. Often Plato's works exhibit a certain degree of dissatisfaction and puzzlement with even those doctrines that are being recommended for consideration. For example, the forms are sometimes described as hypotheses, the form is good in particular, described as something as a mystery whose real name, nature, is elusive and yet unknown to anyone at all. The Republic, isn't that beautiful? And this is where I just find sort of real fraudulent people come up, and I'm standing here for truth, justice and honesty, and you'd know that someone who says that is neither true nor just nor honest. If someone says I'm here for it, because they haven't really thought about it. Not because they're bad people, because they just haven't understood it enough. Puzzles are raised, if not overtly answered, about how any of the forms can be known and how we are to talk about them without falling into contradictions, Parmenides, or whether we know anything, Theoeticus, or to name anything, Cratylus, these words. When one compares Plato with some of other philosophers who are often ranked with him, Aristotle, Aquinas, Kant, so that's why I read Kant for example, he can be recognized as far more explanatory, incompletely systematic, elusive and playful than they are. And that's right, this is why Kant is so hard, it's bloody German. That, along with his gifts as a writer and as a creator of vivid character and dramatic settings, is one of the reasons why he's often thought as an ideal author for whom one should receive one's introduction to philosophy. And when you come to think of it, this playfulness, you can see when, say, Francis Bacon does his novel at the end of his life. He writes a novel in which he puts his ideas, makes it very accessible. His readers are not presented with an elaborate system of doctrines held to be so fully worked out that they are in no need of further explanation or development. Instead, what we often receive from Plato is a few key ideas together with a series of suggestions and problems about how those ideas are to be interrogated and deployed. So, i.e., he's a modern lecturer. This is the thing I used to get into trouble as a teacher. I would create a feeling, create presentations and get students to solve problems. And at the end of it, some of the students who couldn't solve problems saying, "Where's my notes?" Yeah, it's just incredible. Readers of Platonic dialogue are drawn into thinking for themselves about issues raised, if they are to learn what the dialogue itself might be thought to say about them. Many of his works, therefore, give the readers a strong sense of philosophy as a living and unfinished subject, and perhaps one that can never be completed, to which they themselves will have to contribute. Look, I rest my case. I'm just it's just insane. Like, I'm trying to teach, and this is just not understood. I say things I read. I really not have read this first. All of Plato's works are, in some way, meant to leave further work for the readers. But among the ones of the most conspicuously fall into these categories, a whole series, I'll read them. But you can just hear an Australian struggling with, you know, just too many letters. Euthyphro, Laches, Charmides, Euthymenes, Theocles, and Parmenides. So I'll get in and read those. Look, it's not that difficult reading Plato. The Republic. You know, I could read it in 1 hour too. I may read the Republic. I may add on to it, reading the Republic. There's three, a dialogue setting character. There is another feature of Plato's writing that makes him distinct among the great philosophers and colours our experience of him as an author. Nearly everything he wrote takes the form of a dialogue. There is one striking exception, his Apology, which purports to be a speech that Socrates gave in his defence. The Greek word apologia means defensive. A defence. When, in 399, he was legally charged and convicted of the crime of impiety. However, even there, Socrates is presented at one point addressing questions of philosophical character of his accusers, Meletus, and responding to them. In addition, since antiquity, a collection of 13 letters has been included among his collected works, but their authenticity as composition of Plato is not universally accepted among scholars, and many or most of them are almost certainly not his. Most of them purport to be the outcome of his involvement in the politics of Syracuse, a heavily populated Greek city located in Sicily and ruled by tyrants. This is one of the things I do have to point out, which sort of echoes here. We are in a world ruled, in a modern world ruled by tyrants. I do not know anyone who I have, without exception, that tyrants have gotten control of their companies, their organisations. They are indeed tyrants, and you've got Donald Trump as a tyrant. We are, of course, familiar with the dialogue form through our acquaintance with the literary genre of drama. I love it. It is a drama, and it is a play. It's beautiful. But Plato's dialogues do not try to create a fictional world for the purposes of telling a story, as many literary dramas do, nor do they evoke an earlier mystical realm like the creations of the great Greek traditions at Sophocles, Euphrates, I can't pronounce the other ones, Aeschylus. Nor are they all presented in the form of a drama. In many of them, a single speaker narrates the events in which he participated. They are philosophical discussions, debates, would, in some cases, also be the appropriate world among a small number of inoculators, many of whom can be identified as real historical figures. Now, I think, Galileo wrote plays and debates, and I was just trying to think, my head's hurting. I just wish I could keep the memories in things. Someone wrote, people often wrote novels. Galileo and those people. Galileo wrote several plays with the same characters each time. It's beautiful. They are philosophical discussions, debates, would in some cases also be an appropriate word among a small number of interlocutors, many of whom have to be identified as real historical figures, have been identified, and often they begin with a repetition of a setting of a discussion, a visit to a prison, a wealthy man's house, a celebration over drinks, a religious festival, a visit to a gymnasium, a stroll outside the... city walls, a long walk on a hot day. As a group, they form... if you go back to Omar's The Mind of the Strategist, that is a strategic scenario. Is that it? Oh, I've forgotten again. I'll have to read Omar again. So it's your strategic scenario. You're going to a tennis match. In terms of, it's really hard to think of strategy in the void. As a group, they form a visit portraits of a social world. They are not purely intellectual exchanges between characterless and socially unmarked speakers. At any rate, that is true of a large number of Plato's interlocutors, that's characters. However, it must be added that in some works, the speakers display little or no character. See, for instance, the example Sophist and the Statements, dialogues in which the visitor from the town of Ella in southern Italy leads the discussion, and the Laws, a discussion between an unnamed Athenian and two fictional characters, one from Crete and one from Sparta. In many of his dialogues, although not all, Plato is not attempting to draw his readers into discussion, but also commenting on the social, it's not only attempting to draw his readers into a discussion, but also commenting on the social milieu that he is depicting and criticizing characters and ways of life of his interlocutors. Some of the dialogues that almost evidently fall into a category are Protagoras, Georgias, Hippias Major, Euthydemus, and Symposium. I wonder what Symposium is. What I was going to say is that this really there'll be an app associated with that, but if you look at the app is a dialogue, and you can follow different people's dialogues, and you can have different people comment at different points in the same thing. So really, one can look backwards, but you can also look forward. Now, Socrates, poor chap, killed himself eventually. So Socrates really is the template for Christ, as far as I can see. There's one inoculator who speaks in nearly all of Plato's dialogues, being completely absent only in the Laws, where ancient testimony tells us was one of his latest works. That figure is Socrates. Like nearly everyone else who appears in Plato's work, he is not an invention of Plato. There really was a Socrates, just as there really was Crito, Georgias, and Thrasymachus, and Laches. Which is really interesting, because those people can, in real life, come back to you and say, Plato was not the only author whose personal experiences of Socrates led to the dictation of him as a character in one of his dramatic works. So I think Socrates was before Plato. I think Plato was Socrates' students, and then Socrates knocked himself off. Socrates is one of the principal characters of Aristophanes' comedy Clouds. Xenophon, a historian, a military leader, wrote, like Plato, both an apology of Socrates, an account of Socrates' trials, and other works in which Socrates appears as a principal speaker. Furthermore, we have some fragmentary remnants of dialogues written in other contemporaries of Socrates besides Plato and Xenophon. Asthenes, which is like, a teledrama. So it really covers, I think we've got underbelly, where people, actors play and people think they know something. And it makes actual doing real law difficult so we have a very similar theme. These report to describe conversations he conducted with others. So, when Plato wrote dialogues that feature Socrates as a principal speaker, he is both contributing to the genre that inspired by the life of Socrates and participating in the lively literary debate about the kind of person Socrates was and the value of the intellectual conversations in which he was involved. Aristophanes' comics portrayal of Socrates is at the same time a bitter critique of him and other leading intellectual figures of the day. But from Plato, Xenophon, and other composers in the 390s BC and later, of Socratic discourses, as Aristotle calls this body of writings, we receive a far more favourable impression. Well, there you go. So now that was my confusion. Yeah, I'm just an Aussie bloke out here, you know, mowing at my barbie. Don't drink all that much, but you know, you can imagine me drinking my Fosters, you know, backing the footy. And I must admit, I in my head didn't know somehow Plato being Socrates' teacher, but Socrates is the big dadda of them all. Evidently, the historical Socrates was the sort of person who provoked in those who knew him or knew of him a profound response and inspired many of those who came after his influence to write about him. But the portraits composed by Aristophanes, Xenophon and Plato are the ones that have survived intact, and they are therefore the ones that must play the greatest role in shaping a conception of what Socrates was like. Of these, the cloud has the least value as an indication of what it was distinctive of Socrates' modes of philosophizing. After all, it's not intended as a philosophical work, although it may contain a few lines that are characterizations of features unique to Socrates, for the most part is an attack on the philosophical type. The long-haired, unwashed, amoral investigator interprets phenomena, rather than the depiction of Socrates himself. The class. It's just really beautiful. That is, these people are playing with the form. Xenophon's depictions of Socrates, whatever its value as historical testimony, which may be considerable, is only thought to lack the philosophical subtlety and depth of Plato's. At any rate, no one, certainly not Xenophon himself, takes Xenophon to be a major philosopher in his own right. Okay, so really, we really want to unpick who Socrates was, but also, and we've got three angles into it. And you can well imagine, like Socrates himself is a form. It's beautiful. But really, if you want to read it, now this is the treat, is that there's people who really won't know who he is, and there's people who read just the textbook, and we are just going to hammer away and get a read through everything on it. At any rate, when you read his Socratic works, we are not encountering a great philosophical mind. But that is what we experience when we read Plato. It is a great read. And you really have to understand the forms and the structures before. We may read Plato's Socratic dialogues because we are, as Plato evidently wants us to be, interested in who Socrates was, what it stood for, but even if we had little or no desire to learn about the historical Socrates, we will want to read Plato because in doing so we are encountering the author of the greatest philosophical sequence. No doubt, in some way, he in some way borrowed in important ways from Socrates, though it's not easy to say where to draw the line between him and his teacher. But it is widely agreed among the scholars of Plato that Plato is not a mere transcriber of the words of Socrates, any more than Xenophon and other authors are of the Socratic discourses. He uses a figure called Socrates in so many of his dialogues should not be taken to mean that Plato is merely preserving for a greeting public the lessons he learnt from his teacher. What a fantastic thing. So we're up to episode 4, halfway through. I'm feeling a bit tired. I'll put this out. And I've got to get quiz questions for this as well. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.